If you dig the twisted, admire the outlandish, and are enamored by the unusual, you're in the right place. True crime, the supernatural, the unexplained, now you're speaking our language. If you agree, join us as we dive into the darker side. You know, because it's more fun over here. Welcome to Total Conundrum.
Warning, some listeners may find the following content disturbing. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, Conundrum crew, and welcome back to another riveting episode of Total Conundrum. Today, we're plunging into the dark depths of true crime history with a focus of one of the most infamous figures of the 20th century, Charles Manson.
In this episode, we're peeling back the layers of Manson's early life, his formation of the notorious Manson family, and the chilling legacy that followed. It's a tale of manipulation, murder, and madness that continues to fascinate and horrify.
Brace yourselves, Conundrum crew. This is one episode you definitely won't want to miss.
As always, we value your feedback. Please rate and review our podcast on Apple and Spotify, subscribe and like on YouTube, and hit the notification bell so you never miss an episode.
Your support keeps us going. If you have any story ideas or recommendations, contact us at totalconundrum.com or find us on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter.
And don't forget, today we'll share trailers from our podcast pals at Where the Weird Ones Are and the Doorkey Podcast. If you're craving more creepy content, be sure to give them a listen. Without further ado, let's dive into the twisted world of Charles Manson.
We'll be back after these messages.
What's up, frickin' weirdos? My name is Kevin, and I'm the host of Where the Weird Ones Are podcast. This is a conversational podcast based on guest experiences and encounters with paranormal, cryptids, aliens, spirituality, mental health, as well as conspiracies. If these topics interest you, you can find me on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, as well as YouTube and Rumble. If you have an encounter or an experience of something that you can't quite explain, I'd love to hear from you. You can reach out to me at wheretheweirdonesare@gmail.com. where_theweirdonesare on Instagram, and Where the Weird Ones Are on Facebook. I hope to hear from you, my friends. Question everything and stay weird.
Back to the show.
Absolutely. And where better to start than at the very beginning? Right, Tracy?
Totally.
Charles Manson's early days are like the prologue to a horror novel you just can't put down. Born on November 12, 1934, in Cincinnati, Ohio, to a 16-year-old mother, life wasn't exactly handing Charlie the golden ticket.
Oh, definitely. Not excusing any of the horrific events that he created, but it's like his life was set on hard mode from the get-go. His family friend, Virginia Brodigan, said, "I'd have to say, when a child was treated the way he was, you're doomed," which says a lot. His mom, Kathleen Maddox, was super young, struggling addict, and reportedly dabbled in petty crimes to make ends meet. Not exactly the wholesome family dinner, round the table kind of life. In fact, she ended up behind bars for robbery when Charlie was just 4 years old. Because of these events, he was shipped off to live with his grandma.
Right? It means his first memories are of visiting his mom in prison. And it didn't take long before little Charlie was off to his first day of school at, you guessed it, a reform school for children at risk of incarceration. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree after all. But attempts at reformation didn't work. By the age of 9, he was already stealing cars and committing burglaries. Talk about it being a prodigy, but like in the worst possible way.
A prodigy of prison. That's our young Charlie Manson. He was collecting juvenile detention centers like they were Pokemon cards. By the time he was in his late teens, Manson was spending more time behind bars than actually in a bar. And that's saying something considering his mom's alleged fondness for the bottle.
And let's not forget his stints at reform school and institutions. Seems like every couple of years he'd get shuffled off to a new place, which basically taught him all the wrong kinds of lessons, like how to manipulate, charm, and basically get his way through life by using whatever means necessary.
Speaking of charm, that's something that would later become one of his most dangerous tools, don't you think? I mean, the guy was no looker, let's be real. But charisma? That's a whole different story.
Definitely, Tracy. It's almost like during those formative years, Manson was running his own little workshop on how to win friends and influence people into doing absolutely horrifying things. But it's that charisma that eventually helped him gather his notorious family around him.
Which is crazy, because, like, how do you go from being a petty criminal to convincing a bunch of people to follow you into the abyss? But guys, that's a story for another few minutes. We're just setting the stage with his early years of mischief and mayhem.
Certainly. It's those early brushstrokes that paint the picture of the man Manson would become.
Boy, it's only going to get crazier from here. So, Jeremy, how does a guy with a rap sheet as long as a CVS receipt end up leading a cult?
Well, it's all about location, location, location. So they say. After getting out of prison in 1967, Manson moved to San Francisco, right in the throes of the summer of love. Haight-Ashbury was buzzing with hippies, free love, and importantly, lots of lost souls looking for meaning.
Perfect storm, huh? You got this guy who's like a charisma bomb, dropping into the middle of all those peace-loving folks who are high on life and probably a lot more. I mean, if you're looking to start a cult, that's like hitting the jackpot.
That's it. Manson started by playing the guru, spouting his bizarre mix of Scientology, fringe psychology, and his own special brand of biblical apocalypse. He had this way of speaking that, honestly, if you listen to his interviews, it's like a verbal labyrinth.
A verbal labyrinth. I love that. Like, you go in, but you can't find your way out. And his followers, they were mainly young women at first, weren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Young women who were disenfranchised, disconnected from their families. Manson offered them a new family, but not the Brady Bunch. It was more like the Brady Bunch if it was directed by Quentin Tarantino.
Ha! That's a show I'd watch. But with less feet, please. But seriously, it's chilling how he managed to manipulate them. He'd play the role of father, friend, confidant, and then flip to tyrant when needed. He used drugs, meditation, and let's face it, a lot of psychological manipulation to break down their identities and remold them into his image.
Undoubtedly, Tracy, Manson was a maestro of mind control. He had this cocktail of techniques that he used. You mentioned drugs and meditation, but it was also about constant indoctrination. He bombarded them with his philosophies during these long, intense sessions where he'd talk about the Bible mixed with bits of Helter Skelter.
Helter Skelter, yes. Not just a Beatles song, but in Manson's twisted mind, it was an apocalyptic race war he predicted was coming. And he convinced his followers they needed to start the war to save the world. Talk about delusions of grandeur.
Oh, and how about the way he isolated them out there at Spawn Ranch, his sick little hideaway? They were cut off from the world, which just made it easier for Manson to play his mind games. No reality checks from the outside world. It's like they were on their own little planet. Mansonville, population as crazy as it gets.
More like population brainwashed. He'd also do these creepy role-playing sessions where he'd assign them roles from the Bible and make them reenact parts of their past, but twisted to fit his narrative. It was like he was rewriting their realities. Don't you agree?
You got it. And music, Tracy, don't forget the music. Manson used his songs and guitar playing. Yeah, the guy thought he was some kind of thwarted music star to weave his hypnotic vibe around them.
The ego on him. Thank God he wasn't starting all of this up when SoundCloud or YouTube was around. He'd be all over it, thinking he'd be bigger than the Beatles. But those songs were part of his tool set, like spells to enchant these kids. And it wasn't just random hippies. He targeted vulnerable people, young runaways, girls who'd been kicked out or felt lost. And there he was, ready to play their savior.
Yep, and it gets wilder because Manson wasn't just hanging around Heights Asbury by chance. He knew that was where he could find the perfect recruits for his family. He'd cruise around in an old school bus they had converted, picking up hitchhikers and scouting for those who seemed ripe for the picking.
And let's not gloss over how he used sexuality as a control mechanism. Manson's family dynamics were all about using sex to break down boundaries and assert control, further blurring the lines of individual identity within the group.
Absolutely. It was all about dismantling their sense of self so they'd have nothing but him and his crazy vision. From there, it's a small leap to convincing them to commit crimes in the name of Helter Skelter.
It's terrifying how a person can twist reality for others like that.
Without question, Tracy, when we talk about Manson's ideologies, it's a deep, murky pool of madness. He concocted this wild belief system that was a jumble of Scientology, bits of the Bible, some Dale Carnegie, and a whole lot of Charles Manson original flavor.
Originally and definitely not approved by the FDA.
Hell no.
You know, one of the wildest parts of his obsession with the Book of Revelations, Manson was all about those end times.
Right. According to him, black Americans would rise up against the white population, leading to a massive chaos of destruction.
And Manson told his followers that they would be the saviors of the white race. After the war, they'd emerge from the underground city, which, by the way, was supposed to be located somewhere in Death Valley, and basically rule over the survivors. I mean, talk about a doomsday cult script.
It's like he mashed up a dystopian novel with a bad acid trip. And the way he sold this to his followers was through constant repetition and reinforcement. Those family members were subjected to daily sermons where Manson would preach his gospel of doom and salvation.
Not to mention the sleep deprivation and LSD trips. He'd dose them up and then feed these terrifying visions, warping the realities until they couldn't tell up from down, let alone right from wrong. He'd serve visions so twisted, they'd make Salvador Dali say, "Maybe that's a bit much."
Yeah, and Manson's control didn't end with just messing with their heads. He was all about controlling every aspect of their lives. What they ate, what they spoke, who they could talk to. If they stepped out of line, the consequences could be brutal. Manson didn't shy away from violence to keep his followers in line.
Spot on, Jeremy. And let's not forget, he was using his interpretation of the Beatles song, yes, the Beatles, as proof of his theories. Songs like Helter Skelter, Blackbird, and Revolution 9 were all part of what he saw as the soundtrack for his apocalyptic vision.
Can you imagine being so twisted that you turned Blackbird into an anthem for a race war? But that was Manson's talent, taking something existing and warping it to fit his narrative. Only Manson could hear a song about hope and think, yep, that will scare the masses. It's like he thought the Beatles were the four horsemen of the apocalypse.
It really shows you the power of charisma and manipulation. Manson was no ordinary con man. He was a puppet master pulling at the sanity of his followers.
Speaking of puppet masters, let's not forget the puppets. Some of Manson's most loyal followers who became infamous in their own right. I'm talking about the likes of Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkle, and Leslie Van Houten. These were central figures in the Manson family drama.
Oh, for sure. Susan Adkins, or Sexy Sadie, as they called her in the family.
Whoop, whoop!
Talk about a nickname that didn't quite match the resume. Cold-blooded murderer? She's about as sexy as a tax audit. She was there that night at the Tate residence, participating in one of the most horrific crimes of the 20th century. Her confessions later would chill anyone to the bone.
And then there's Patricia Krenwinkle, or as Manson liked to call her, Big Patty. Before her life took a sharp left turn into Crazy Town, she was just your typical secretary, typing memos, filing faxes, and doing the daily coffee run. Can you imagine going from organizing office supplies to organizing a cult crime spree? It's like she swapped staples for stabbing in the ultimate career pivot. She played a crucial role in the murders, and her transformation under Manson's control was one of the most drastic.
Now I know 9 to 5 can be a drag, but talk about a career change for the worse. And let's not forget Leslie Van Houten. She went from homecoming queen and cheerleader, basically the poster child for the girl next door, to poster child for why you lock your doors at night. She traded her pom-poms for a pair of handcuffs. It's absolutely wild how Manson could take these seemingly normal prep rally going individuals and turn them into cold-blooded killers.
It's like he had a recipe for disaster, and he mixed these personalities together until they were ready to boil over. Each of these women brought something different to the family, but under Manson's direction, they ended up walking down the same dark path.
A charismatic leader can warp minds and turn people against their moral compass. I mean, that's happened in history a few times now. These women who once had lives and futures ahead of them ended up with life sentences and their names forever linked to the unimaginable crimes.
And it's not like they were monsters from the start. They were lost, vulnerable, searching for something, anything that felt like a purpose or belonging. Manson just happened to provide them with a nightmare version of that.
You got that right. And as we dive deeper into the events that unfolded under Manson's instructions, we see not just a story of a man and his madness, but also a cautionary tale about the power dynamics within groups and how they can lead to tragic outcomes.
Speaking of group dynamics, let's not forget the other key players in this twisted saga. Each member had a role, like cogs in Manson's destructive machine. Take Tex Watson, for example. Originally from Texas, he was a high school athlete and honor student before he turned into Manson's right-hand man.
Sure, Tex Watson really epitomizes how Manson could twist just about anyone's path. He went from track races to leading the charge on those infamous nights. Instead of his running shoes that night, he put on his homicide boots.
Homicide boots? Where do you buy those then?
I'm not sure what they would even look like. Watson claimed, "I am the devil."
Yeah, you are.
"I am here to do the devil's business."
Yes, you did.
And was responsible for organizing much of the violence. You twisted fuck.
Uh-huh. That's Tex Watson for you, going from high school track star to clocking in for the devil's business. Like it's just another day at the office. Seriously, what kind of job description is that?
Not one I'd want.
Must be one hell of a career shift. And then there's Linda Caspian, who was brought into the family not long before the murders. She was present during the Tate-LaBianca murders, but turned state evidence, which is the only reason she avoided a longer sentence. Her role, she was often the lookout, the eyes and the ears, with the madness unfolding.
Crazy how roles evolve in such a group, huh? From lookouts to leaders and lunacy. Another member who gets overlooked is Bobby Bousselet. His murder of Gary Heineman under Manson's instruction really sets the stage for for the later, more infamous murders. Boussillet was sort of a sign of what was to come, showing just how far Manson could push his followers.
And don't forget the girls who weren't front and center. Lynette Squeaky Fromm, who didn't participate in the Tate-LaBianca murders, but would later make headlines for attempting to assassinate President Ford in 1975. Talk about taking your hobbies to the next level. Manson had these people wrapped around his finger, ready to do anything for him, whether it was keeping the ranch in order or attempting presidential assassination.
That's pretty damn brazen.
Yeah.
It's a whole spectrum of manipulation, and each member tells a different part of the story. Manson's ability to find and exploit the vulnerabilities in these people is truly unsettling. They started as lost souls, and he molded them into disciples of chaos.
And that's it, isn't it? It's not just about Manson or even the murders. It's about how a group dynamic can be leveraged by a charismatic leader to enforce total obedience.
Yeah, it shows the importance of understanding these dynamics, not just to sate our curiosity about past crimes, but to prevent future ones. As we dig into the specific crimes next, keep in mind how each member's background and role contributed to the unfolding of these nights.
Well, although it's been decades since the horrors, believe it or not, life went on for those who survived the aftermath.
It sure did, Jeremy, starting with the most infamous Charles Manson himself, who never saw freedom again. He passed away in 2017 in prison, but not before leaving a trail of bizarre interviews and a following that still weirdly clings to his mad legacy. He once said in an interview, "I'm a tramp, a bum, a hobo. I'm a boxcar and a jug of wine and a straight razor." What the fuck do any of those things have to do with each other?
I'm not sure.
What did somebody slip him in prison?
Straight razor? More like straight up lunatic.
Uh-huh.
And what about his followers, the key players? Take Leslie Van Houten, for instance. She's been up for parole a bunch of times, correct?
Yeah. Leslie Van Houten, who became sort of the poster child for rehabilitation, has been recommended for parole several times since 2016 due to her model behavior in prison and her extensive work in rehabilitation programs. However, her release were blocked by the governor each time. She's a prime example of the debate between punishment and rehabilitation. It's like she's on Groundhog's Day. Wake up, apply for parole, get rejected for parole, and start all over again.
Then there's Patricia Krenwinkel, still incarcerated since 1971, and as of our last update, the longest incarcerated female inmate in California. Talk about a record you don't want to break. At this point, she might as well get a trophy that says, "Thanks for hanging out with us for half a century." She was imprisoned back when bell bottoms and disco balls were all the rage. Since she's been in, we've gone through nearly 20 iterations of the iPhone. She went in when phones were attached to walls, and now they're smart enough to run our lives. She's been denied parole multiple times, with the board citing the severity of her crimes as a continuing risk.
And Susan Atkins, remember her? She passed away in prison back in 2009 after being denied compassionate release despite her terminal illness. These dark paths have had grim endings.
Sure. Tex Watson went from proclaiming himself the devil to preaching the gospel. As an ordained minister in prison, that's quite the career switch. Talk about going from Hellraiser to Hallelujah. But even with that holy makeover, his parole requests have been repeatedly denied due to the gravity of his crimes.
And during our research, didn't you say that he has a podcast?
He has a podcast.
How?
In prison.
How?
I'm not sure.
That should not be allowed.
And I think it has something to do with love.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I'm not completely sure. It's been a while.
Well, the Holy Spirit can only do so much, it seems. It's a complex picture, isn't it? On one hand, you've got the sordid past, and on the other, you see these glimmers of change. It raises big questions about the nature of the justice system, punishment, and the possibility of redemption.
Exactly. And these stories also show the ongoing impact on the victims' families. They've consistently opposed parole, obviously with good reason.
So let's take a moment to think about the impact of the Manson family. Let's remember both the victims and their potential, cut so short. Whether you believe in redemption or retribution, the story of the Manson family doesn't leave anyone untouched.
Definitely not, Tracy. Speaking of not leaving anyone untouched, let's lay out the timeline that led up to those infamous nights. The Manson family didn't just suddenly snap. It was a crescendo of craziness that culminated in those brutal murders.
You know, it all started to unravel in the spring and summer of 1969. Manson's helter-skelter theory was in full swing, and his hold over the family was ironclad. They had been living at Spahn Ranch, and Manson was preaching that the end of the world was near, but they needed to kickstart it.
And boy, kickstart it they did. Let's take a closer look at the harrowing night at 10050 CeeLo Drive. It was August 8th, 1969, a date that would be etched in infamy. The Manson followers, under direct orders, were about to unleash a night of absolute terror.
Yeah, it's just chilling. Once they arrived, Tex Watson cut the phone lines to the house. They spotted a car driving towards them as they approached the property. Watson stopped the car, and inside was 18-year-old Stephen Parent, a friend of the estate's caretaker. Watson shot him before he could even step out, marking the beginning of a rampage.
So young, such a shame. With the perimeter secured, they cut through the screen of the door, and Watson, along with Susan Atkins and Patricia Krenwinkle, climbed inside. Linda Caspian was left outside to keep watch. Inside the house were Sharon Tate, celebrity hairstylist Jay Sebring, coffee heiress Abigail Folgers, and Wycheck Frykowski, and a friend of Polanski.
God, the terror they inflicted that night. It's even hard to discuss. They woke the sleeping occupants, gathered them into the living room, and it's reported that they bound Tate and Sebring together by their necks with ropes and slung the ropes over the living room's ceiling beams.
Yeah, and when Sebring protested the rough treatment of the pregnant Tate, Watson shot him. Then the chaos escalated quickly. Frykowski and Folgers managed to briefly escape, but they were chased down and brutally stabbed outside of the house.
Susan Atkins then turned her attention back to Sharon Tate, who pleaded for her life and that of her unborn child. But mercy wasn't on the cards that night. Atkins coldly rejected Tate's pleas and brutally murdered her. Before leaving, Atkins used Tate's blood to write "pig" on the front door, a grisly message intended to shock and confuse authorities.
And the aftermath was just as horrifying as the murders themselves. The police found the scene the next morning, and it was something out of a horror movie. Blood everywhere, and the victims, it was just a massacre.
It shook Hollywood to its core. Celebrities were terrified. Everyone thought they might be next. The randomness and brutality of the murders left everyone bewildered and frightened.
This single night's events would ripple through the cultural consciousness for decades, but we'll explore the next. This wasn't the end of the Manson reign of terror.
Right? If anyone thought the horror at CeeLo Drive was a nightmarish one-off, they were horribly mistaken. The next night, August 10th, Manson himself decided to up the ante. He wasn't satisfied with just directing. This time, he wanted to ensure his grim message was loud and clear.
That's true, Tracy. Manson, unhappy with the random chaos of the previous night, thought his followers hadn't made enough of an impact. So he took Watson, Krenwinkle, and Leslie Van Houten this time and drove off to select a new target, leading them to the La Bianca residence in Los Feliz.
Manson and Watson entered the La Bianca home first, under the guise of being robbers, subduing Leno and Rosemary La Bianca at gunpoint. They reassured the couple that they wouldn't be hurt and were just there to rob them. The calm before the storm.
Absolutely sickening. After tying up the La Biancas, Manson returned to the car to fetch Krenwinkel and Van Houten. He then left, directing his minions to leave a sign, something witchy, that followed was a brutal, unnecessary slaughter.
We'll be back after these messages.
Hello, my name is April, and I'm the host of the history podcast, Your Key. Your Key is two words, your and key. It's a play on the word dorkie, which is really fitting because I'm a dork who loves to talk about history and random events and people from history. So come join me as I dive into these events and people. From Ootsie the Iceman to Studio 54, I cover it all in a way that's easy to consume. Get ready to hear a new and different perspective and gain a deeper understanding of the past while having some fun along the way. Welcome to Door Key. You can find and subscribe to Door Key anywhere you listen to podcasts. And Door Key is on all social medias as Door Key Pod. So be sure to check all of that out as well. Talk to you soon, friends.
And back to the show.
Watson and Krenwinkel took on Leno LaBianca, stabbing him multiple times. They carved the word war into his abdomen and left a carving fork sticking out of his stomach, a grotesque overkill. Meanwhile, Leslie Van Houten repeatedly stabbed Rosemary LaBianca in the back, ensuring that the scene at the LaBianca house was as horrific as the one at CeeLo Drive.
The murderers used the La Bianca's blood to write a message like "Rise and death to pigs" on the wall. They even left a pillowcase over Rosemary's head, secured with a lamp cord. The scene was meticulously designed to shock and terrorize, a clear escalation from the previous night's madness.
The randomness of these attacks, the fact that the La Biancas were just ordinary people chosen at random, intensified the fear gripping Los Angeles. The city was paralyzed, thinking anyone could be next. The Manson family had sown terror in the heart of Hollywood, and now broader LA was on the edge.
Manson's apocalyptic vision had morphed into a tangible, horrifying reality. Next, we'll dive into how this nightmare came to an end, how the Manson family was finally caught and brought to justice.
So after all that horror, the big question is, how did they finally catch these monsters? It's almost anticlimactic, but the downfall of the Manson family started with a bunch of car thieves, not a master detective cracking the case.
Yeah, I can't believe Manson's grand scheme unraveled over something as mundane as a car theft. In late 1969, the family got a bit too greedy and started a spree of stealing cars. They were planning to use them to escape to the desert, part of Manson's delusional plan for surviving helter-skelter.
You know, they were hoarding dune buggies and other vehicles to prepare for the apocalypse. Only, this plan led to their capture. In October 1969, the police raided Spahn Ranch, thinking they were busting a major auto theft ring. Little did they know they were actually stepping into the lair of the Tate LaBianca murderers.
During the raid, the cops nabbed almost everyone, including Manson. But initially, they had no idea they were arresting the culprits behind those gruesome murders. It was only because Susan Atkins, who was already in jail for another crime, started bragging about the killings that the police put two and two together.
Classic case of loose lips sink ships. Atkins was there for auto theft charges, and she started spilling the beans to her cellmates about how she and her family had carried out the murders at CeeLo Drive. You know, boasting about killing Sharon Tate really caught the attention of the authorities.
That's when the pieces of the puzzle began to fit together. The LAPD and the Sheriff's Department, who had been working these cases separately, started to connect the dots, linking the bizarre writings in blood at the murder scene to the Atkins confessions.
And once Atkins started talking, the floodgates opened. Eventually, Tex Watkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Leslie Van Houten were also arrested and charged. The trial itself was a spectacle, but the confessions and evidence were overwhelming.
It's ironic, isn't it? Manson's family, bound by secrecy and loyalty, ultimately undone by their own people. If they hadn't got greedy with the cars, who knows how long they might have continued their reign of terror.
It's terrifying to imagine, Jeremy. Even the most calculated crimes can be unraveled by the simplest mistakes.
And boy, was that trial a spectacle. The Manson family saved all their theatrical antics for the courtroom. The trial of Charles Manson and his followers kicked off in June 1970, and it quickly turned into a media circus.
For sure, Jeremy. From the get-go, Manson orchestrated his defense like a dark, twisted show. He walked into the courtroom with an X carved into his forehead, which he later turned into a swastika. It was his way of declaring that he was Xing himself out of society.
Bye!
Bye is right. Goodbye.
Crazy. And his followers didn't just sit there quietly either. They mimicked his behavior, shaved their heads, and even carved crosses into their own foreheads. Outside the courtroom, more family members sang songs and chanted, trying to sway public opinion and create a scene.
And let's not forget the disruptions inside the courtroom. Manson was constantly being silenced or removed for outbursts. One time, he leapt across the defense table trying to attack the judge. If it wasn't so terrifying, it'd be like something out of a bizarre movie.
Exactly. And amidst all this chaos, the actual evidence was overwhelming. The prosecution laid out a detailed account of how Manson had masterminded the murders, directing his followers to kill. The testimonies from Linda Caspian and other key witnesses painted a vivid and chilling picture of those nights.
Speaking of chilling, remember when Susan Atkins, who was not part of the main trial because she had already pleaded guilty, testified during the penalty phase for her co-defendants? She recounted the Tate murders with such cold detail that it left the courtroom in shock.
Yeah, her testimony was a bombshell. But throughout it all, Manson maintained that he was innocent, that he hadn't actually killed anyone. His defense argued that he was a scapegoat, a symbol of societal fear towards the counterculture. But given all the evidence and the testimonies of his co-defendants, it was a hard sell.
Hard sell indeed, and it didn't work. The jury didn't buy it for one second. Manson and several key followers were found guilty on all counts. It was a verdict that felt like a small measure of justice, but the scars they left on so many lives could never be erased.
After that bombshell of a trial, the next big question was, what kind of sentence would they face? Initially, Manson, Watson, Krenwinkel, and Van Houten were sentenced to death. But that was just the beginning of a long, convoluted aftermath.
Oh, no doubt about it. But then 1972 rolled around, and California's Supreme Court invalidated all death sentences issued prior to 1972 due to constitutional concerns. That meant these sentences were automatically commuted to life in prison, which opened up a whole new can of worms with parole hearings and all that jazz.
Indeed, and those parole hearings became their own kind of spectacle. Manson himself turned each appearance into a stage for his bizarre rants and theatrics. He never showed any remorse, continuing to spout his strange philosophies and blaming society for his crimes. In a strange twist of fate, he also wrote a letter expressing his desires to be imprisoned at the same prison his mom went to, the prison he visited regularly at the tender age of 4. the authorities of that prison actually responded to the letter and wrote that it would be a cold day in hell before they allowed him behind their bars.
Yes, definitely, and very bizarre. And the women, Krenwinkel, Van Houten, and Adkins, took slightly different paths. Over the decades, each of them became involved in prison programs, education, counseling, you name it. They claimed to have reformed, which I suppose we'll never really know.
Speaking of sparking debates, the Manson family have had a huge influence on media and entertainment too. Their stories became a dark inspiration for creators across books, films, and music.
No question, Jeremy. I mean, look at us now. We're recording a whole podcast about them. You can't talk about the cultural impact of the Manson family without mentioning some of the most iconic works they've inspired. Take the book Helter Skelter, written by the prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi. It's pretty much the definitive account of the Manson family murders and the trial. That book became a bestseller and was even turned into a television movie, which scared the heebie-jeebies out of viewers back in the day.
Oh, for sure. And then there's the music world. Manson always fancied himself a musician. And before everything went down, he was rubbing elbows with the Beach Boys. Dennis Wilson actually recorded a song Manson wrote, originally titled Cease to Exist, but it was reworked into Never Learn Not to Love and released on their album, which gives me the creeps just thinking about it.
I will never think of the Beach Boys the same again. It's just super creepy, Jeremy. Manson's influence did not stop there. Bands like Guns N' Roses and Marilyn Manson, whose stage name is partly inspired by Charles Manson, have covered his songs or mentioned him in their music. It's like his infamy added this allure that still captures the imagination of musicians.
And let's not forget the films. I mean, how many movies have we seen that touch on or dive deep into the Manson lore? There's The Manson Family, which was more of an indie take. But then you've got big Hollywood names like Tarantino filming Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which reimagines the era and events in a very Tarantino way.
Right. And it's not just the traditional media either. The Manson story has been examined and re-examined in countless documentaries and podcasts.
Podcasts?
What are those?
Really?
Each trying to understand the why and how, or simply to retell the terrifying events.
There's no doubt that the Manson family saga has become ingrained in the fabric of American pop culture. Whether it's seen as a cautionary tale or just morbid fascination, it keeps coming back into the spotlight, getting us to look deeper into the psyche behind the madness.
That's the power of storytelling, Jeremy. It can turn history into horror, lessons into legacies, and real-life monsters into media myths. We're fascinated, repelled, and captivated all at once.
And speaking of myths and legacies, let's talk about the lasting impact this whole Manson saga had on American culture, especially on the 60s counterculture. The era was defined by peace and love, but the Manson family kind of flipped that on its head.
Totally, Jeremy. The 60s counterculture was all about rejecting conventional society, exploring new freedoms, and challenging the status quo. There was this idea of building a better, more open, and accepting world. Then comes Manson, who on the surface seemed to embody these anti-establishment ideals, but boy, did he twist them into something dark.
Absolutely. He exploited the openness and the trust that defined the counterculture, using its own ideals against it. After the murders, there was a massive shift. The vibe of love and freedom started to get overshadowed by suspicion and fear. People began to question the movement, wondering if it had allowed monsters like Manson to hide in plain sight.
And it wasn't just a fleeting moment of doubt either. The Manson family murders served as kind of a wake-up call. The media latched onto Manson as the symbol of the dangers lurking within the hippie movement. It was like overnight, the flower power idealism got a dose of sinister reality, coloring public perception of the counterculture from then on.
Certainly, and it changed the music scene too. The peace-loving tune of the early 60s started to evolve into something with a harder edge. Bands like Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin brought in darker, more complex themes in their music.
I agree, Jeremy. And on a broader scale, the Manson murders marked the end of an era. The 70s rolled in with much more jaded and guarded approach to personal freedom and community living. Communes and open-door policies weren't seen the same way anymore. It's like the innocence of the 60s was lost, and in its place, a more cautious and skeptical culture emerged.
A single event, or in this case, a series of tragic events, can ripple through society for decades after.
A movement founded on peace was forever altered by an act of violence.
That goes nicely into what we're talking about next, the nature of cults and their leaders. The Manson family was also a classic example of how charismatic leaders can manipulate those vulnerabilities in our social fabric.
I agree, Jeremy. Manson's ability to manipulate his followers was classic cult leader behavior. He exploited their search for meaning, their need for belonging, and twisted it for his own horrifying ends. It's a pattern we see repeated in cults across history and even today.
Right, and it all comes down to the power of dynamics, doesn't it? These leaders often present themselves as messiahs, as the only ones who can provide answers during turbulent times. Manson did just that. He presented himself as a sort of prophet of the apocalypse and promised his followers salvation, all while binding them to him with fear and manipulation.
And what's really chilling is how these leaders use techniques, but they take them to the extreme.
They're masters of exploiting weaknesses, aren't they? It started with love bombing, showering new recruits with affection and acceptance. Then it moves into isolating them from their old lives, their family, and friends. And before you know it, the leader's voice becomes the only one they can hear, the only one they believe.
And the scary part is, once someone is drawn into that web, it's incredibly difficult to break free. The psychological grip of a cult can be stronger than any physical chains. We saw that with the Manson family, how deep the devotion ran and how far they were willing to go for Manson.
Understanding how these cult figures operate could help prevent the rise of such dangerous influences.
Well said, Jeremy. Education, awareness, and open conversations like this one are our best tools against manipulation.
Who knows? Our podcast just might save the world one day.
Or we'll have our own cult of conundrum. It could go either way at this point.
True that. And that concludes another gripping episode of Total Conundrum. We've uncovered the dark shadows of the Manson saga, and it's been a wild ride.
Thanks for sticking with us, Conundrum crew. Make sure to follow, rate, and review our podcast on Apple and Spotify. Don't forget to subscribe and like on YouTube and hit that notification bell so you're always in the loop.
Your feedback is super important to us. If you have any story ideas or recommendations, feel free to reach out at totalconundrum.com or connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter.
Until we meet again in the next episode, keep on creeping on. We love you.
Catch you later, Conundrum crew. Bye. Thanks for hanging out with us here at Total Conundrum. Please make sure to check out our website and blog at totalconundrum.com for news, upcoming events, merch, bloopers, and additional hysteria. You never know what will pop up, so be sure to follow along. If you want to show your support for Total Conundrum and gain access to all of our bonus content, please visit our Patreon page. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The links are available in our show notes. If you have any questions, comments, recommendations, or stories to share, please email us at contact@totalconundrum.com. Episodes are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. If you like the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate the love. Keep on creeping on, mother cluckers.